I would watch Chet and my father in the garage while Chet would mimic closing the hood of the car on my father's head or dance around making funny faces at me while my father asked him for some tool that he thought would aid in restarting the engine of whatever outdated jalopy he had his head under. Even as a kid, that felt so silly to watch, sitting there being embarrassed for my own father, pretending he could do things that he couldn't. Chet was an actual engineer, so he understood mechanics, and when my father would eventually throw his hands up, having exhausted all possibilities known to him, Chet would step in and actually fix the car. Chet was a man the day he was born. My dad seemed like a boy who got big. They call it a macher in Yiddish, all talk, very little action. My father always made grand, sweeping hand gestures when he spoke, which was one of the various bad habits I picked up from him. My brother never moved his hands when he spoke. He didn't have to. Most nights, I would fall asleep on the couch in Chet's room, or I'd pretend to fall asleep because that's how I got him to carry me. He picked me up off the couch in the same way you'd pick up a handicapped person, and that's when I felt the warmest feeling in the world, like I was being looked after. I knew in those steps to my room that I was loved, that the man I loved the most loved me right back. Having an older brother is a lot like a crush. In fact, it is a crush. You have someone you love and adore who never loses his temper with you, who's always looking out for you and looking after you, and that becomes your definition of what love means. Maybe I've canonized my brother into something much more than he was. Did his smile linger a little longer at me in my memories? Perhaps. But maybe he smiled even more than I'm giving him credit for. Maybe he was even more than I remember. But this is my memory, the one that has been stuck in my head for over 30 years, collecting dust. One August, we were coming back from Martha's Vineyard at the end of our summer, a 5-hour car ride from Woods Hole, Massachusetts, to Livingston, New Jersey. Chet knew how much I loved the cold air, so he wrapped me up in blankets and rolled down the windows, and we drove like that the whole way home, listening to Neil Young. When I'd open my eyes a crack to make sure he wasn't too cold, he'd shiver dramatically in his flannel shirt and say, "God, this is so miserable," with a huge smirk on his face, or maybe smirk isn't the right word. It was less than a smile and more than a smirk. It was a grin. Chet always had that grin. When we finally pulled into our driveway late that night, I wasn't asleep, but I pretended to be. He carried me up the stairs to my room, singing some silly commercial about a ferry boat in Falmouth, Massachusetts. That was always on the radio. "Sail away to Falmouth, sail away on the Island Queen." Then he tucked me in bed, wide awake, with my eyes closed, and turned the fan that was sitting on my nightstand to high. He was the only person in my family who understood that I was born going through menopause and that whenever I ate soup, I had to take my top off. He always made me feel like precious cargo. "Why do you want to go hiking? For what?" I wanted to know through bites of cereal. "Is it because you have a girlfriend?" "No, it's not because I have a girlfriend." My brother crinkled his nose a lot when he was teasing me. And then I'd crinkle my nose back like we were on the show Bewitched, minus the sound effects. He told me that he was going to California to rent a car and then drive from there to the Grand Canyon and Zion Canyon and then on to hike the Grand Tetons. "You're going to be on the vineyard anyway. You won't even be here," he said through bites of my signature dish of raisin bran and sliced bananas. "But why do you have to go at all?" I asked him. "Why don't you just come to the vineyard with us? I don't want to drive with Mom to the vineyard." My mom drove very slowly, hated having the windows open on a freeway, and listened to Dr. Laura Schlesinger, or whatever her name is. "I want to drive with you," I whined. I was too young to think about anyone else's interests but my own, too young to think that maybe he deserved a fucking vacation after graduating from college and looking after our whole family his entire life, too young to consider what it must have been like to be him and the sense of responsibility he must have felt to all of us, including my parents, too young to know that people take vacations without their families. "It's only 2 weeks. I'll be back before you know it, and then I'll come straight to the vineyard when I'm back. You won't even know I'm gone. By the end of summer, you'll be wishing I had stayed on vacation, because I'm going to make sure that every single day we go sailing, you're going to end up in the bay with Bruce." I flicked a banana slice off my spoon in his direction. Bruce was the shark from the movie Jaws. Parts of Jaws were filmed in Catawba Bay in front of our house in Martha's Vineyard the year I was born. A mechanical shark my brothers and sisters believed still lived in the bay, even though filming had concluded 9 years earlier. Sailing with Chet was the best adventure ever. He had a little sunfish sailboat and would take some of us, or all of us, out on the bay in front of our house, and almost every single time at some point, you'd never know exactly when, he'd suddenly tip the boat over, and whoever was in the boat ended up in the water screaming. Laughter combined with the terror of bumping into the remains of Bruce. Then he would tip the boat back on its right side, get himself up, and come lift me out of the water. Then he'd pin me down on the boat and accuse me of tipping over the boat. And for some reason, the silliness of this made me laugh even harder. And all my siblings knew that if I was laughing hard, peeing in my pants was right around the corner. And that's when he'd throw me right back in the water. Rinse, cycle, repeat. The thrill was real every time. Danger, but with the cushion of safety. I can still smell the orange life jackets he made us wear, and not because they smelled like urine. They smelled like my brother, salt and wood and beach and home. I need a little vacation, Chels. Do you really think I'd leave you with these people? His nose was crinkling again, and I made a sad face and tried not to cry. My brother was like a father to me, but far less embarrassing. He was handsome, and he wasn't obese. My father wasn't obese at this point in our lives, but all signs were pointing in that direction. My dad was in charge of everything. He ran the show, and he was the person who said no to things. My mom said yes to everything, candy at any time during the day. She didn't care whether or not you cleaned your room or what time you went to bed or if you brushed your teeth or hair, for that matter. I could have gone to school pantsless if I wanted to. It's actually surprising I didn't. My mom was the one you always wanted to be home. She was fine with whichever way the wind blew. I once walked into our summer house on a rainy day with a six-pack of Heineken that my friend and I stole from her parents' fridge. "We're going to try beer," I told my mom, who just rolled her eyes and went back to crocheting my father a sweater. I was 10. My dad was the problem. He was the one who we were all scared of. If any of our brothers or sisters wanted anything, it was up to Chet or me to ask. Chet was the oldest, and I was the youngest. We were bookends. It was around 9 p.m. when my sister Simone and I walked into our house in the vineyard, and as soon as we did, my mother was at the top of the stairs with a face I'd never seen before. She looked distorted. Her face was blotchy, and she was leaning on the banister, clutching herself. It looked like she had been attacked. Simone took what was left of our ice cream cones and headed to the kitchen to toss them into the trash. I stood frozen, looking at my mother, who wasn't talking, and I was wondering if there was an intruder in the house. And if so, were we supposed to run out of the house to get the police and leave her there? No, we can't do that. Was he still in the house? What was happening? Why wasn't anyone saying anything? Seconds felt like minutes. Simone came back from the kitchen to the bottom of the stairwell where I was standing, still frozen, and looked at me with dread in her eyes, and then looked up at my mother's distorted face. "Your brother's dead." My mom didn't specify which brother because she didn't have to. Simone and I both knew it was Chet. He had gone on a trip and didn't stay with the family, and now he was gone forever. Just like that. You don't believe these moments when they happen. You believe they have the wrong guy, that it was his friend. It wasn't him. Your brain is moving so fast at all the things that have changed in just a blink of an eye, what it all means. It means we are 5, not 6 anymore. It meant our family was broken. There are only 5 of us now. That's not the right number. We need 6. 6 is our number. We are a team. Now I have a dead brother? What do you mean dead? Is that final? I ran into the bedroom at the bottom of the stairs and threw myself onto the bed and cried and screamed and wailed in agony. Death is agony. There is simply no other way to describe it. It is getting the wind knocked out of you over and over again, and just when you think you have enough strength to take a deep breath, it knocks you down again. There is no break from the pain. It is arduous, unyielding. I remember thinking, this is what I'm supposed to do now. Jump onto the bed and bury your face in your tears. Just pretend you're acting. Do what they do on soap operas. I didn't think about my mother or my father or my brothers or my sisters. All I could think about was what he said to me, that he lied to me. My brother left me with the very people he said he wouldn't. My bookend was gone, and now things were really out of control. No, this isn't happening. It isn't him. It can't be. He's too strong to die. They're going to find his body and find out it's someone else's brother. I got down on my knees and prayed for someone else's brother to be dead. You have to get up. We have to go help mom. You need to come upstairs to be with mom. It was Simone. Simone was the oldest girl, and Chet was the oldest boy. She had just lost her partner, too. That never occurred to me then. I sat on the bed with my mom as she recounted my father's phone call from New Jersey. I remember sitting there wondering if this was what she was going to look like from now on. A foreigner. She said when my dad called to tell her, she only heard moaning on the other side of the phone. The police had come to my father's door, and somehow knowing he had a heart condition, he'd had a heart attack a year earlier, they had sat him down before they told him. He couldn't talk when he called my mom. He just kept moaning into the phone until the police took the phone and told my mother what had happened. Years later, my sister, Shoshana, was telling someone the story of how she found out Chet died, and it was similar to mine. "You weren't there," I told her. "You weren't with us." "Of course I was there, Chelsea. We were all there together. I came home from babysitting, and you and Simone were upstairs with Mom. Simone went outside while Mom told me because I guess she couldn't bear to hear the news twice." I had no recollection of Shauna being there that night. I only remember Simone taking me out for ice cream at the Dairy Queen in Edgartown and bumping into some of her friends at the gas station, and they asked about Chet. "He's in Wyoming hiking. He'll be back next week," Simone told them. The thing I remember most vividly is the ice cream and Simone knowing to throw it away when she saw my mother's grief-stricken face. She knew before my mother said a word to throw the ice cream away. I remember wanting to ask her why we needed to throw away perfectly good ice cream, but I knew enough not to. I remember our neighbor coming over with a bottle of red wine, which I remember thinking was inappropriate because we weren't celebrating. I remember wondering why all of a sudden we liked our neighbor when all we'd done was talk about what a pain in the ass she was. I didn't understand why she was at our house or why my mother, who almost never drank alcohol, was downing red wine. I remember waking up in the morning and thinking that all deaths should happen in the daylight. All bad news should come in the morning. That way you have the whole day to get used to your new reality so that the first daylight you see after death doesn't feel like a plane nosediving into the ocean, with the damage becoming worse the deeper into the sea you go. In death, the aftermath is worse than the crash. My mom packed up our family van and we got on the very first ferry off the island to Woods Hole and drove the 5 hours back to New Jersey. No one spoke. My father and my brother Roy walked out the front door when we pulled into our driveway in New Jersey. Chet's car was parked on the bottom left-hand side. Roy and my dad were both crying and walking toward us like zombies with their arms open. I had never seen my father cry before and I didn't like it. It was sunny out, which made no sense to me. Birds were chirping. The weather was not commensurate with death. I wanted everyone to go inside, not on the lawn, not like this in front of all the neighbors. I bypassed all the hugging and went inside to look for Chet. If his car was in the driveway, it meant that he was home. I bet nobody even looked in his room. I walked into his room and I could smell him. I looked in his closet and I smelled his flannel shirts. Then I called out his name, but it was like one of those dreams where no sound comes out. "This can't be happening. This can't happen. Our family can't take a hit like this." I remember thinking there was no way my parents had budgeted for a funeral. The domino effect of Chet going off and letting himself die was going to be brutal. How could he have let this happen? Then there were the optics. Now everyone would know for sure our family was broken, because now our family really was broken. We were already skating on thin ice because my parents were known to be less than traditional and a little bit too lackadaisical. No other adults or parents seemed to take an interest in getting to know either of my parents, nor did any clear-thinking adult allow their children to spend time at our house with such a lack of supervision. Now we had a dead brother because my parents let their son go hiking in the Grand Tetons, and he had never hiked a mountain like that before. They were unfit, and now there was proof. There were people in and out of our house all week. We sat Shiva, which, for those of you who aren't familiar with Jewish customs, is a week of mourning for the loss of a loved one, with a lot of deli meat. People came over with deli platters and all sorts of food, smoked fish, cakes, pies, cookies. Everything seemed so unappealing. There was a never-ending supply of corned beef and hot pastrami. Your thoughts become so miscellaneous. I remember looking at all these people I didn't know who were in our house and trying to figure out the difference between corned beef and pastrami. They both seemed awful. I remember watching my father collapse on our sofa in front of our bay window, right in front of our next-door neighbors. My father was strong. He was a physically big man. I remember him heaving and sobbing and his shoulders crumpling, and I was desperate for him to stop. What is he doing? I couldn't understand how he was letting people see him in that condition. I wanted my father to comfort me, but everyone was comforting him. He was emasculating himself. If he was losing it, then whatever we had left as a family was slipping away. We were unmoored. Even though Chet was the leader of the kids, my dad was the leader of the family. He wore the pants, and you did what he said, and he set the tone, and he was foundering. I looked at my dad's best friend, Jay Gaydamack, and I remember thinking that I wanted him to be my father. Maybe because he wasn't crying. Maybe I was attracted to that. I don't remember. We're now 5, not 6. We were over. I remember our relatives looking with pity at my father. I hated that. They already thought we were misfits or vagabonds, and now this? I liked attention, but I didn't like this kind of attention. I didn't want pity. It was weak. My father was being weak. I remember that the word professional kept popping into my brain. My father was being unprofessional. How on earth was I going to be able to restore any dignity to this family I was born into? Now we were outcasts and we were victims. I could deal with being outcast because I had Chet. He was never an outcast. Everyone loved Chet. My dad was an outcast, and now he was acting like a victim, and he was making victims out of all of us. I stared at him hard with my eyes. Stop this. You're making a spectacle of us. The subject of buying a family plot came up. My dad wanted to buy other plots next to my brother so that he and my mother could be buried next to him. I remember my parents talking to our rabbi about having an open casket, even though my brother's body had been badly damaged, and something about his chest and forehead being caved in, and Jews typically didn't have open casket funerals, but my mother was demanding it. He's my son, and I want to say goodbye to him, she told the rabbi. I remember these words exactly because I had never seen my mom demand anything from anyone. My father looked at my mother when she said that, and I remember thinking he had never seen her demand anything either. For the first time in my life, in that moment, my mother was more in control than my father. The rabbi was telling my father that in order to be buried in a Jewish cemetery, my mother would have to convert to Judaism. Wait, what? I thought my mom was Jewish, mostly because no one ever told me she wasn't. During all of my brothers and sisters' bar and bat mitzvahs, my mother would go up on the bima and speak Hebrew, just like all the other Jewish mothers did during everyone else's bar and bat mitzvahs. She even went with my father and me to temple some Friday nights. Apparently, my mother was Mormon, and when she came over from Germany to marry my father, she agreed to raise their children Jewish. I had never heard the word Mormon before. I always thought that when my dad called my mom a shiksa, he was talking about her being German. I didn't know that shiksa meant a non-Jew. Didn't your mother have to be Jewish in order for you to be Jewish? Was I not Jewish either? More great news. There was a funeral, and all I remember were my brothers Glenn and Roy taking turns holding me in their laps as we all sat and cried throughout the service. I remember thinking, why say such a thing if you didn't mean it? Why not be extra careful when you're on a fucking mountain peak if you promised your littlest sister that you would spend the rest of the summer tipping her over in a sailboat? Why would you break that promise to her? I was livid. I remember my German grandfather Fati coming over and saying to Roy, you're the oldest now. You need to take care of your brothers and sisters. I remember thinking, Roy isn't the oldest. There is no oldest anymore. We are a pot without a lid. They'd had to pump Chet's body with embalming fluid so that his face could be viewed. He looked dead and bloated. The funeral ended, and I guess at some point we went back to Martha's Vineyard to finish out our summer. I don't remember. The day after the funeral must have been around the time I stopped crying. If everyone in my family was going to fall apart, and the only person who held our shit together just let himself go off and die after he promised me that he would come back after his trip, then I would have to be strong on my own. From that day onward, if I saw my mother crying or heard my parents groaning in anguish in their bedroom in the early hours of the morning, I would leave the house and get on my bike. I would ride my bike for hours and cry. But I would not allow myself to cry in front of anyone else or show any weakness. I would not talk about my brother to my family. If his name came up, I left the room and went for a bike ride. I would ride and ride and cry and then walk back in the front door numb, hoping no one was there. No one being home was better than anyone being home. At some point on the vineyard that summer, my mother was standing on the deck looking at the water, saying she was just waiting for a dream or a sign that Chet was okay, something from God. She wanted Chet to tell her he was safe and in heaven. She was trying to recruit me. That's how it felt when she tried to talk to me about Chet. It felt like she was trying to trick me into crying. I walked away from her and told her that there was no God and there was no heaven, and out of everyone in the world, she should know that by now. My mother was in pain, and I chose to stab her again. I couldn't understand anyone else's pain. I couldn't even understand my own. I was confused and I was so mad. I remember thinking, if Chet ever comes back, I'm not just going to go back to the way things were before. No, I was going to punish him for what he did. I remember asking my dad, who would sit for hours on the deck, staring at the bay, if he would take me swimming. My dad taught me how to swim when I was 2 or 3, whenever he was on the vineyard, because he commuted back and forth to New Jersey in the summer for a non-existent used car business, end quotes. He would carry me down from the house to the bay and hold me in his arms as he walked us into the water, and then I would swim with him on his back and climb on top of his shoulders and dive over the top of his head. I'd swim back to him, holding my breath underwater until I was right back in his arms. I loved swimming with my dad. After that, he would carry me up the path back to our house and tell me that I was stronger than anyone else he knew and that I'd probably end up competing in the Olympics. My father didn't respond the first time, so I asked him a second time. "We're not going in the water," he growled. "How can I go in the water when my boy is dead?" His face was always contorted back then, wretched. It hurt to look at both of my parents. I knew it was a risk to defy my father, but I was desperate for him to snap out of it. There was absolutely no light in him, and it was sucking the life out of what was left of the rest of us. If I could just get him into the water, I knew he would relax a little or find a little ray of sunshine, or at least I could hold on to his back and then trick him into a hug. I just wanted him to breathe. I wanted to breathe too. The water was safe because if I started crying, I could just dunk my head and shake it off. If anyone could get him to experience some joy, it would be me. I turned away from him and defiantly walked down the steps and across the lawn to the path that led down to the water. I never looked back because I was scared shitless about how he would react to seeing me swim alone. The only rule I ever had growing up was never to swim alone. I thought about getting spanked in the water and how funny that would be for both of us, him trying to catch me in the water to spank me. We'd both end up laughing so hard I'd inevitably pee, and then I knew my dad was mine. I could always get everyone in my family to laugh. I would just be in my pants. That got everyone every time. When I got down to the water, I nervously swam out about 20 yards. When I mustered up the courage with every kind of fear pulsating through my body for having defied him, I looked back and saw he had gone inside. I haven't had a bowl of cereal since that night in the kitchen with my brother. My brothers and sisters continued eating cereal all the time growing up. I didn't understand that, how they could do something that Chet loved so much, knowing what we knew. I didn't understand it because I was only able to draw from my own experience and didn't have the faculties to grasp that their relationships to cereal weren't as linked to Chet as mine were. That not everyone has your history or your past, that my brothers and sisters had their own memories of Chet, which didn't involve cereal or even me. That each person has their own individual memory of the way things happen, and that you can waste so much time being angry at cereal. I only ate eggs after Chet died. I spent the last 33 years looking at cereal with disdain. Cereal was for children. Cereal was for 9-year-olds before they got their hearts broken. Cereal was off limits. One day, when I was around 15, I went foraging through the attic and found the pictures of my brother, head caved in, crumpled among rocks. I saw the pictures most parents would have made a better effort of hiding. His head, his chest, everything was crushed. Blood splattered the rocks above him. His limp body with his torn flannel shirt and jean shorts. The mountain rangers and paramedics said he would have died instantly. Lucky for him, I thought, looking at those photos. The rest of our pain was taking forever. Tammy time. There are many things dogs can do to make you feel like a better human being, like run toward you. For the record, I'm not one of those people who cares more about animals than humans, but I am someone who knows that loving a dog makes you a kinder and fuller person. I don't have such luck with babies, and the feeling is mutual, so when I realized dogs were receptive to me, I returned the favor. My obsession with chow chow mixes came alive only when I rescued Chunk and was told he was a chow mix. After 6 years, I decided it was time for Chunk to have a sibling. If Chunk was my firstborn, then Tammy was the stepdaughter that I loved almost more than my own blood. Tammy was a tramp, and that's what I respected about her the most. The minute I saw her, I knew she was my dog. First, she was a chow mix, and she had the purple tongue to prove it. Second, everything about her screamed Guadalajara. She looked like she had survived more than one street fight, and possibly one with an animal that wasn't a dog. She had one dead ear, alopecia on her ass, a very scantily clad tail, and a gait that hinted she had withstood hip replacement surgery. Tammy was essentially a Build-A-Bear, and I knew that with some maternal attention from my cleaning ladies and some serious nutrition, I could turn that gait into a swagger. She was exactly the type of dog who could pull off an ear piercing. We rescued Tammy from a facility in Long Beach, where, for the record, my cousin Molly said the following, "You can't get that dog, she's the ugliest one here." I didn't think she was ugly. I thought she gave new meaning to the term underdog. There was nothing ugly about her, scrappy maybe, like she could have been carrying a pocket knife. She needed me, and whatever her name would turn out to be, I knew I needed her right back. Even though Molly is 12 years younger than I am, she's smarter and more capable than I'll ever be. But in this particular instance, I knew I had the ability to see what would be overlooked by most everyone else. That's the great thing about Molly. She knows I'm right about the things that get me in the gut. If I want to give a stranger $10,000 and she thinks they're going to spend it on crack, just because I met that person in a crack den, I will defer to Molly. She'll say something along the lines of, "Let's sleep on that, and if you still feel that way in the morning, then we'll do it and you'll have my full support." That meant no. In this instance, Molly knew I meant business. I was rescuing Tammy and was going to give her what she needed, some real-life pampering. Someone to show her she was special. After all, when I get dogs, they aren't just being rescued by me. They are getting the love and attention of my cleaning ladies, my assistants, my dog walker, and everyone else who either works at my house or meanders through it on a regular basis. Older dogs are special because they've had more rejection. Their hope is gone, and even though no one seems to know exactly how old any rescue dog is, when you adopt an older dog, you are cramming their last years with love and giving them the security that comes with knowing they have a home. I've always believed that you can erase bad memories with twice as many good ones. Maybe erase isn't the right word. Maybe dim is a better word. After the people at the rescue center cleaned up Tammy, the two women handling her adoption told me that she could be a really beat-up 4-year-old or she could be 12, and that I should ask my vet for clarification when she had her first checkup. When the rescue presented Tammy to us, they had placed a little pink bow in each ear, the full-bodied ear and the limp one. She looked like a harlot. Once we got her in the car on our way home, we removed those embarrassing gender labels from her ears and got down to business. "I feel like we have two names to choose from," I told Molly on our way back to my house. "Bernice or Tammy?" "Or Destiny," Molly said, with the dog sitting on her lap looking at the 405 freeway in awe. "Destiny is totally underused." The first night I had Tammy home, I had some people over for dinner. I picked her up and placed her in my lap facing me, leaving both of her curiously stiff front paws positioned around either of my hips. Mary craned her head over the dinner table amazed and said, "Is she hugging you? I've never seen a dog do that." "Chelsea's making her," Molly told Mary. I wasn't making Tammy do anything. I was showing her the seating options available to her, and one option was on my lap facing me. Chunk would never sit on my lap. A, he was just too big, and B, he valued his personal space. I had finally found someone who didn't. Tammy's teeth looked like she was from London. So when Tanner took her to her first vet appointment for a once-over, the nurse called and told me she may need to have all of her teeth removed. "Why would that be necessary?" I asked the nurse. "Because they could all be infected," she informed me. "Yeah, but isn't there a way to tell which ones are infected first before removing all of them?" "Well, we won't really know until we put her under and take a look." "But how will she eat with no teeth?" I asked. "Well, we won't take out any of the teeth that aren't infected," she assured me. I was confused by this exchange. Felt like I was talking to a real live animal on the phone. "Listen, I just don't want any teeth that aren't infected to be removed. Is that clear? Otherwise, I can just take her to my own dentist on Monday." Poor Tammy. I wasn't about to let her move to Bel Air with no teeth. Before the dog nurse hung up, I asked if they had been able to decipher Tammy's age from her teeth state of affairs. "Well, she could be anywhere from 4 or 5 to 12. It's hard to say." Is it written somewhere in the Journal of Medicine for Dogs to just say that all rescue dogs are between the ages of 4 and 12? How can it be that a swab of saliva can determine a dog's genetic heritage, yet there isn't a more precise way to determine the age of a dog at this juncture in modern society? This is a question for everyone. Tammy would allow me to do almost anything to her body, and I needed her to know that she was going to get so tackled with love that her past would become a distant memory replaced by doggy massages, acupuncture, and baton twirling. She would let out a low rumble growl, and I would go in closer, waiting for her to bite my face off, but she never once bit me. She bit my sister Shauna once, but we all agreed that it was warranted. Tammy knew I was her captor and that it was in her best interest to just lean in and accept my devotion. Once I was done showering her with affection, she'd give me a final look to confirm that I was done molesting her, then scurry off the bed and down her doggy steps into the doggy bed that she'd usurped from Chunk. Once comfortably inside her new bed, she let out a groan that implied, "Oh, thank God that's over." I couldn't keep my hands off her. I'd put her in a seatbelt on my lap on the way to work when I knew she'd be much happier sitting in the backseat with her limbs free and one dead ear out the window. I can be an effusive lover, and after our initial trial period together, she just learned to deal with my advances. She was just big enough for it to be imprudent to pick her up, but that didn't stop me either. She would immediately stiffen up with her legs outstretched as if she were standing, making her look stuffed. She was a taxidermist's dream. Chunk was slim, but I'm not sure how to describe Tammy's body. It seemed possible that some of her organs had shifted during one of her bar fights and then solidified. Her bald spots filled out within weeks, and her rat-like tail became full-bodied within her first month at home. She looked like an ad for nutrition. She even started following me on stage during the interview segment on my Netflix show and would sometimes prop herself up on the little table between the guest and me. She didn't give a shit what anyone thought about her. She just wanted to make sure we were in the same room, nothing more, nothing less. She would have been fine if I never pampered or pet her, but like most rescue dogs, if I walked out of the room, she'd follow me. If I walked into a bathroom, she would open the door with her nose and stare at me until I was done. Chunk did the same thing in a more needy way. He'd open the bathroom door, or if we were at work, he'd slide headfirst under the bathroom stall and then avoid eye contact. Tammy would do these things, but with confidence. Where Chunk was refined, Tammy was street. She'd sit down in front of the toilet face to face as if to say, "Bitch, you need me more than I need you. I'm just keeping an eye on things." Tammy was more like a security guard. She wasn't quite as spry as Chunk, so I didn't bring her on trips with me because she couldn't hop on and off planes and helicopters. But she was mentally fit, so there was backlash. That's what led me to get a third dog. I thought another dog would help distract Tammy from the fact that Chunk and I were traveling around the world. I didn't want her to feel excluded since she was smart enough to hold a grudge. My friend Kate, who is one of those people who loves animals more than people, texted me a picture of a dog that was at a rescue in Westwood, with a message that read, "This guy needs a home and he's part Chow Chow." This is what people do when they want me to rescue dogs. They tell me they are part Chow Chow. I went down to the rescue in Westwood and picked up our new dog. The girls working there told me he could be anywhere between 4 and 12. I brought our new family member home and decided his name would be John. He was sweet and goofy and was definitely a big puppy. I figured he was probably 2. That night, in an effort to not overthink assimilating my new brood, I put all 3 dogs in my bedroom and popped an edible. I was awakened by a low rumble that rose to a roar and then to something that sounded like there was a werewolf nearby. When I flipped the lights on, Tammy's mid-sized, corpulent body had somehow wrapped itself around John's like a contortionist. Thank God for instinct, because I'm scared to think what I would have done had I given it any thought. I screamed, "No!" and then ripped Tammy off him. Her eyes were red and she looked like she was wearing red lipstick. I tossed her toward my closet. John was a bigger dog and stronger than I thought, and I couldn't hold him back from barreling toward her. So I dove right in the middle of them, grabbed Tammy, pushed her headfirst into my closet, and shut the door. Then I scurried to my feet in my staple sleepwear, a Braun thong, and fended off John, who was growling with his nose to the closet. Once I got him outside my room and closed the door, I sat down on my bed and thought I was going into cardiac arrest. I was gasping for breath as I tried to figure out what to do next. I was scared of both dogs at that point. I didn't know what they were capable of after seeing Tammy basically shapeshift herself into an anaconda. When I moved my hand to my chest to try to self-soothe, I realized my bra had been torn open and one of my breasts had been set loose and was bleeding. I looked over at Chunk, who at some point during the altercation had wrapped himself inside the drapes. I don't want to call Chunk a pussy, and I don't want to call Tammy a cunt, but I want to just throw those 2 words out there. I called Molly and told her that I was living with a real-life Cujo, and even though I knew it was Tammy's fault, I was scared to open the door and check on John. "I'll come get him," Molly said. It was 12:30 a.m., and while I waited for the coast to be clear, I texted Brandon to scan the security cameras in the morning and save whatever footage had just been captured for the next time me and my friends did mushrooms. John never made the cut because Tammy took him to task. Chunk knew better than to fight over territory he'd conquered long ago. He knew he belonged with me, but he understood there would be random dogs coming in and out of our lives, just the way people did. Tammy was with me for 3 years and died shortly after the inauguration in January 2017. She felt the same way I did about Donald Trump. Molly and I were in South Africa at the time, and I got the call while Molly was out getting gifts for her brothers and sisters. She came back to the hotel room where I was sitting in a chair feeling guilty about traveling so much and not spending time at home with Tammy. "You gave her a good life, Chels," Molly said, hugging me. "No one else would have ever adopted that dog." Do you know how much shorter her life would have been if you'd been home more? And don't forget, she brought me Hodor. Hodor is the name that Molly gave John after she rescued him from my house. After Tammy died, I had some friends over for a small memorial service at my house where we watched the video footage from my security cameras the night of the attack. It was the first time I had seen the crime scene, and Brandon had scored it to the theme song of Rocky. In it, you can see Tammy actually airborne after I got her off of John. The four teeth that I had campaigned for Tammy to keep ended up biting me in the tit. If I hadn't busted my nut with my topless photo rampage years before, this video would have been released on all of my social media platforms on a loop. Watching the video of Tammy alone pacing in my closet like a large brown bear reminded me what a force of nature she was. She was an underdog and a badass. She was a fighter, and even though I don't spend much time looking in the rearview mirror, my biggest regret is not ever getting her ears pierced. Seymour. In our next session, Dan told me about self-defining relationships. The critical relationships that are formative, that determine the person you become. The relationships that, if they were to go away, would change you. You would never recover from the loss. So everything goes back to Chet, really? I asked Dan. That seems too obvious. How do you mean? Like, too easy. Is it really that simple? Am I really that simple? Although it was a relief, at the same time, it seemed like another cliche. Of course, that's how simple this has always been. Well, it sounds twofold to me, he said. It sounds like you had one injury when your brother died, which you've said you've never properly addressed, and the second trauma was the retreat of the rest of your family, your father especially. So let's talk more about that. I don't remember much about those first few years after Chet died, other than that I had tons of problems at school. I became trouble. Did you have trouble at school before your brother died? Dan asked me. I don't really recall, but now that we're talking about it, I mean, how much trouble could I have gotten into before the age of 9? It's not like I was Satan. I think it was partly because my parents were so unreliable, so I think other parents wanted to avoid them, and partly because the attention I used to get at home had disappeared, and in response to that, I tried to get attention in other ways at school, however I could, which resulted in me constantly having to stay after school and sit in detention, and then one by one, I was ostracized by all the friends I had in elementary school, not because of my brother's death, but because I had turned into someone else. Every once in a while, I would self-analyze just to show Dan that I wasn't a complete moron and also to surprise myself with what I'd known all along but had never said out loud. My sister Simone and my brother Glenn became my de facto parents after Chet died, or at least they were a more reasonable version of parents. I think Roy had gone off to live in Miami or something. He smoked a lot of pot and needed a place he could do that without my father screaming at him all the time. Shauna was there, but for some reason, I don't really remember her during that time. But how much parenting could they have provided, really? I mean, Glenn and Simone were both in college at Emory University, and any time there was a crisis at home, of which there were many, one of them, usually Simone, had to manage it by phone from Atlanta. The crisis usually consisted of my father and me going to battle about the trouble I was in at school, my not listening to anything he or my mother told me, and my general lack of respect for anyone in a position of authority. I became terrible. I hated everyone. I hated everything, shoving any pain in my pocket, hoping that eventually it would form a hole and fall out onto the street during one of my bike rides. I remember being on those bike rides, sailing past our neighbor's houses so fast that the tears were blowing off my face. This is what the adults should be doing, I thought, figuring out a way to handle the situation without falling apart. I would force myself up the hills around our neighborhood on my banana seat bicycle and think, you need to get stronger. Strength is what everyone in this family is missing. I'll probably have to start lifting weights. I was dancing farther and farther away from myself. I learned from Dan that being in motion was a way for me to avoid sitting still with my feelings. You can't let anyone see you cry, so you move. Action is motion, is doing. Sitting as being. I had been a doer my entire life. I never sat still long enough to let anyone unglue my pain. Dan wanted to know more about my father. The best way to describe my father is that he's a lot like Donald Trump, but less successful, thank God. Otherwise, the damage he could have unleashed on innocent people could have been more widespread. I would use the word shyster to describe my father. He claimed his entire life that if his own father hadn't died and left him a gas station, he'd be a civil rights attorney or a famous poet. My father respected civil rights just about as much as he respected a hot pastrami sandwich, I told Dan. Based on his confused facial expression, I put it in less abstract terms. If one's body is a temple, my father's body is an IHOP. I don't know much about his poetry because, well, he's not a famous poet, that's why. I organized my thoughts and opinions of my father in the most succinct way I could, hoping to give Dan a clear overview without shocking him. He's very non-traditional, and you'll probably be alarmed by some of the things you hear, at least that's my hope. Also, he wasn't abusive, verbally at times, but not physically. He definitely spanked me a few times when I was little and smacked me across the face a couple of times when I was too old to be spanked, but that stopped when I finally hit him back one day. I would also like to add that I deserve to be hit. One can argue that no child deserves to be hit, but a slap across the face once or twice in your life sends a strong message, and the reason I don't have children is partly because of my belief in sending a strong message to people when they are assholes, and lots of kids are assholes. I went on to tell Dan about going with my father to Friday night services at Temple, which used to be our thing when I was a little girl. My mom let me dress up in whatever ridiculous outfit I wanted, which was usually a combination of anything hot pink combined with red. I thought for a long time that those two colors were great together until later in life when I fashioned the phrase summer whore to describe that very look. My mom would slap some tights on me for good measure, and my father and I would go on our date night. After Chet died, my dad didn't want to go to Temple, but my mother somehow convinced him that I needed to go, which was silly in the sense that I had no regard for religion. Temple was about me being my dad's favorite. None of the older kids ever wanted to go to Temple on a Friday night because they had more interesting things to do. If I could just get him to Temple, he would have to hold hands with me. That was our jam when I was a little girl. I'd get dressed up and he'd show me off to the congregation, and then when the rabbi would ask one of the kids to answer whatever question he posed to the congregation, I'd raise my hand and the rabbi would always call on me, probably because no other kids raise their hands, and then I'd run up to the bima and the rabbi would pick me up and I'd whisper into his ear, "I don't know," really loudly. Then the whole congregation would laugh and I'd run back to my father and he'd put me in his lap and we'd both be beaming. But now that I was 9 or 10, I wasn't so little, so my outfits were no longer cute. I looked more like a child prostitute. And the only person who was still physically able to pick me up had gone off and let himself die. Temple was a disaster that night because everyone in the synagogue was coming up to my father and telling him how sorry they were about Chet. Fuck, I remember thinking, when were people going to get over this already? I was trying to get my father back to some sort of routine, and all these people kept interrupting my progress. There were cookies after every Friday night service, so afterward I excused myself to go collect them and bring some back home for my mother. When I came back to look for my dad, I couldn't find him anywhere, and I started to panic. I ran back and forth through all the rooms in the temple in search of him. Where was he? Did something happen? No, 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 not again. My panic turned to hysteria. A woman I knew from temple saw me and came over to me and tried to calm me down. I hadn't cried in front of anyone for months, so it was more like hyperventilating, not being able to breathe but not crying, like the girl in Jaws who saw her boyfriend get eaten by the shark and was left out to sea for hours until Roy Scheider found her inside the sailboat curled up in a ball in shock. More people were gathering around, and then a woman kneeled down in front of me, put her hands on my shoulders, and told me to breathe. Then someone in the crowd whispered to someone else that they had seen my father leave moments earlier and that he seemed out of it. He had driven home without me. I wanted to die right there and then. I remember telling the people standing around me that I was fine to walk home. I don't even know if I knew how to get home from Temple at that age. Plus, it would have been 9 p.m. on a Friday night. Maybe I'd get hit by a car and then my father would have no choice but to wake up. Two dead kids. That would teach him. The rabbi came over and I remember seeing him in plain clothes without his Jewish garb on and wondering if he was going to take me home with him and if I would just become part of his family. He wouldn't forget to pick me up, and his clothes were clean and pressed, and he seemed so normal, like a professional. Professionals showed up when they were supposed to. Why couldn't my dad just be more professional? Instead, the rabbi drove me home, and when we got to our house, my dad's car was in the driveway, and our rabbi walked me to the front door. "Your dad is in a lot of pain, Chelsea," he said. "I know you must be too." "I just have a stomachache," I told him. "I'm fine." "If it's okay with you, I'm going to come inside and talk to him." "Okay, whatever," I said. I opened the front door, which was always left unlocked, and all the lights were off. Of course, everyone was asleep. I needed to recover these optics quickly. "He's just sick," I told the rabbi as we stood in the darkness of our front hallway. "He's got a heart condition, and sometimes he gets heart attacks." My rabbi kissed me on the forehead and said something in Hebrew that I didn't understand. Dan told me to stop talking, to sit with the feeling of my father driving home without me. Sitting with my feelings meant it was time to cry again. I wondered how many more sessions would be like this. It was fucking exhausting, and our sessions were in the morning, which meant I'd show up to work for hair and makeup looking like I had just gotten into a fight with a cherry snow cone. I put myself through this because it was a psychological workout. It was easy to not address my own issues and to focus on everyone else's. Judging other people had become my way of avoiding judgment of myself, and I had to do better than that. Going back to Dan week after week, knowing that I was stripping away all the layers of protection I had spent years fortifying, was particularly dreadful. I knew it was worth continuing. If you went to the gym every day, you were going to get stronger, and this was my mental gym. Also, I added when I felt like enough time had passed, my parents did this kind of shit all the time. They'd forget to pick us up from Hebrew school or regular school, and it wasn't just me. It happened to my brothers and sisters before I was born, so I don't think we can blame this on Chet. My sister Simone went to school with the three older boys for an entire week when she was 4 years old because my mom thought you could just do that. She didn't really understand how things worked in this country. Well, what do you mean? Dan asked. Where was she from? She was German, but she was fluent in English. That wasn't the problem. She was just so laissez-faire about everything. The school called her and told her that Simone wasn't old enough for kindergarten and they couldn't allow her to keep coming. You have to understand that my parents were not equipped or interested in conventional parenting. They were off, and they were like that before Chet died. My dad worked when the older kids were growing up, and I guess my mother was usually asleep, so it was always mayhem. It probably was worse for me because the older kids were all gone, and that was after my dad had sold the gas station and worked from home, which meant that he had a big oak desk with a lot of papers on it that meant nothing, and a big room he called his office, also in quotes. Oh, and he had a fax machine. He never shut the fuck up about that either. He'd tell waiters at restaurants that they could fax in the bill as if that were ever an option in any sort of reality ever. He also used a toothbrush to comb my hair when I couldn't find a hairbrush one morning before school and my mom was away somewhere. I just want you to know the kind of operation my parents were running. Was your mother depressed? Dan wanted to know. Well, maybe, but she also just loved to sleep. My grandmother, who was a Nazi, by the way, would always tell the story that the teacher at my mother's school in Germany used to find her taking naps underneath the staircase every afternoon. She just loved sleeping. Our whole family can sleep for hours, especially when we're all together. Either we bore the shit out of one another, or it's genetic. I can sleep for 14 hours straight, with a Xanax 20. Well, we can talk about the Xanax later. Was your grandmother really a Nazi? Well, no, not really, but she was in Germany during the war, so she was complicit, like Ivanka. Okay, back to your father. Right. After that, my father and I couldn't be in the same room for a long period of time without screaming at each other. All I wanted to do was get out of the house and stay out of the house, and all my father seemed to want to do was force me to sit at home and punish me. What was he punishing you for? Dan asked. Everything and nothing. He just hated me. Well, I mean, I know he didn't hate me, but that's what it felt like. And what did that feel like? Dan leaned forward, his forearms on his knees, hands clasped. I just told you, Miracle Ear, like he hated me. I didn't call Dan Miracle Ear, but I thought about it. But what did that feel like? Dan did this a lot, asked me a question I had already answered. He wanted me to understand that the outward feeling was not the only feeling. He pushed me to identify what was underneath that feeling, which was anger, and then sadness, and then rejection. I felt alone, that I couldn't rely on anyone but myself, helpless. Now I know that my stubbornness was patrilineal, that it came directly from the person who had withdrawn his affection. If he still loved me, he wasn't about to tell me, and I surely wasn't going to ask him to love me. Two obstinate assholes, reeling in pain. Things could have been so much easier if we had just had the ability to reach out to each other. Our signals were always crossed, I told Dan. None of us had the tools. Well, that's why you're here, he told me, to get the tools. I definitely remember loving my father before Chet died and not loving him after, so there's that, I added. Well, you probably loved him still, but you were hurt, and it sounds like you turned that hurt into anger. Because as I said, anger is motion, and it allows you to avoid sitting with your feelings. In a sense, you felt that your father had broken up with you too. That must have been really scary for a little girl. Getting broken up with twice by the age of 9. I had never looked at it that way. Yeah, that's a lot of male rejection before I even got my period. 2 guys in the span of 1 year, and I hadn't even started dating. I had on no occasion thought about my experiences within this kind of framework or thought about how my father must have felt losing his firstborn son. Of course he was wrecked. Who wouldn't be? Why would he have any inkling of how to handle losing a child? No one has any idea what to do with that news. That must have been when I realized I needed to grow myself up, I said to Dan, to become a fixer. Probably, Dan agreed. No one helped you with your pain. You were too young to deal with it on your own, and it sounds like when everyone around you disengaged, your pain turned into anger, which turned into motion, and from everything you're telling me, you haven't stopped moving since. Yeah, that sounds about right. I just needed him, and he had this terrible habit of showing up only at times when I didn't want him to. Like at school, I just didn't want my dad representing me. Why not? Because he was loud and mostly disheveled, and his outfits were the casual equivalent of what I wore to temple on Friday nights. I just believed I was better at advocating for myself. Plus, my mom was sweet and quiet, and I wanted more people to see her, to see that I had a mother that was like other mothers, one who showed up. And how did that feel? Lonely! Most days in elementary school, I could easily walk to school and back by myself, but the winter weather required transportation by car, and since my parents didn't want to deal with that, they farmed me out to our neighbor. In exchange for a ride to school on winter mornings, my parents offered up my math tutoring services to their second grader, Samson. Even though I was in the fourth grade at the time, I shouldn't have been tutoring anyone on any subject, least of all math. After a few weeks, it became apparent that Samson was smarter than I was, and that's when he and I got philosophical and just started playing Super Mario Brothers. I remember walking home from Samson's house one afternoon around 5 p.m. and being asked by my father, in one of his bouts of selective parenting, where I'd been. The zoo, I told him, and walked into the kitchen to see if my mom had cooked anything. Oh, did you have a field trip? My mom asked sweetly, standing with her back to me over the stove. No, I just went on my own, I told her. As if a 9-year-old had the wherewithal to take a day trip to the zoo, solo. My father went back to reading the newspaper, and my mother asked me if I was hungry. I was always hungry, so I took a bowl of whatever she was making and walked upstairs to my room, where I could at least be consistent with the company I was keeping. I wanted someone to look after me, someone who would ask where I'd been. I wanted a mother who wanted other kids' parents' phone numbers. I wanted parents who didn't bounce checks. I wanted to be picked up from Hebrew school on time or at all in a car with 4 doors that opened and closed. I wanted to escape, to go away to boarding school, anything to get away from him and all the friends I had lost. My parents couldn't afford boarding school, otherwise they would have been glad to send me. They were just as tired of me as I was of them. I would make my way through one group of friends and then move on to another, and when I was out of people, my parents would transfer me to a different school. I went from being a sweet and feisty and happy and spoiled little girl who just had to smile to get anything I wanted to being a girl who had the rug ripped out from under her and everything she considered to be love taken away. I didn't understand what was happening, but I was so angry. I was losing my grip and flailing around, and I couldn't calm down long enough for anyone to help me because I really didn't believe anyone could. No one seemed reliable. I remember once sitting around for some family dinner, and I must have been around 13. There weren't many of us there, just my parents and Shauna, and I looked around the table thinking, these are not my people. I thought, I'm going to have to branch out on my own at some point. I mean, obviously, I'll keep in touch with these people because they've had a hand in keeping me alive and feeding me, but this can't be my real family. And what did that feel like? Dan asked. I think I wanted to reject them before they could reject me, I told Dan. Dan asked me if my parents had any grief counseling or if they took any of us to therapy. This was laughable. They didn't know anything about therapy or what responsible people did when their children died. They thought a parent-teacher conference was a social mixer for adults simply because it was at night. Therefore, it made no difference whether they showed up or not. The subject of therapy never came up except for the time I woke up and pretended I couldn't move my legs. Well, what was wrong with your legs? Dan asked. I believe I was trying to avoid a German test that I had neglected to study for, but now that we're talking about all of this, I could have just feigned being sick. If that was the case, because my parents generally didn't challenge that. I remember saying something to my mom about having polio and her rolling her eyes at me, which made me work even harder at convincing her I had polio. I must have been 13 or 14 at the time. At the emergency room that day, the doctor pricked my legs up and down with a needle while I pretended not to feel a thing. And when he was done, he drew the curtain to my examination room shut and suggested to my parents that I have a psychiatric evaluation. They brought me to 3 different therapists, but I refused to speak to any of them. I just sat there and grimaced and stared each one down until they gave up. Every therapist who gave up was another win. I was as stubborn as I needed to be, and when anyone around me gave up on me, I had won again. They had failed the test, another faker who pretended they cared but really didn't. Saying all of these incredibly embarrassing things out loud to someone made me feel sick mostly. I thought about the absurdity of being 42 years old and opting to get a psychiatric evaluation from a doctor after telling him a story about getting a psychiatric evaluation from another doctor. What a full circle. My father may as well have been dead at that point, I told Dan. He was never the same after Chet died. None of us were, but he never really came back until years later. And then there was a good 10 years of happier times. Tell me about that. I mean, I love him now, but it took a long time for us to reconnect. It wasn't until I moved to Los Angeles and came home to visit them. I would come home for a week during Christmas and a week in the summer, and my dad would pick me up at Newark Airport. I remember loving that. I would be so excited on the flight and then running out to see him, and he always had a great big reaction to seeing me, arms waving in the hair, happy, smiling big. As I recounted this to Dan, I remember never having to wait for my father at the airport other than for him to circle the area in order to avoid getting a ticket from the police. He always picked me up when I came home, and I never had to wait for him. I had forgotten that. Dan was looking at me with the recognition of what I'd just discovered. He finally started showing up for me. I knew to sit with that before Dan had to tell me. I had to leave my parents to love them again. I had to move across the country to appreciate that I actually had any pull toward them, that I needed them. I had to get away from them in order to come back to them. I'd like to say that they did the best that they could, but that couldn't have been their best. I wasn't doing my best either, so the idea that everyone is always doing the best they can is a trope. Some people are just interested in surviving. Doing their best doesn't even occur to them. I felt loved by my dad again, celebrated. He was impressed that I'd moved to Los Angeles at 19 on my own and was doing stand-up comedy, and he wanted to hear everything and anything about my life. When I think back about that time, I'm struck by my fearlessness, my drive, my ambition. It doesn't even feel like me now. I'm jealous of that girl, a girl with a plan. I knew exactly what I was going to be, and I was right, powerful. My intention broadsided any challenge that came my way. I didn't care what anyone thought, what anyone said. All I wanted was my own life, and I was going to keep moving until I got it. I wanted to be a person people could depend on, and I was going to do it my way. One would have to be young and stupid to believe that you are going to move to Los Angeles to become famous, which is exactly what it takes to achieve a fantasy, youth and stupidity. I remember one summer flying into Newark Airport, my parents picking me up in their gold Dodge Caravan and driving the 5 hours up the I-95 to catch the ferry from Woods Hole to Martha's Vineyard. Why I didn't just fly to Boston is strange, because it would have saved me a car ride with my parents that wasn't luxurious or alluring on any level. So the only conclusion can be that I was severely dehydrated for their attention. I wanted to be their only focus, and for that 5 hour car ride and subsequent 45-minute ferry ride, that's exactly what I got. I remember us pulling up to one of those McDonald's rest stops on the way to the ferry, and I was tired and cranky from my overnight flight and also grossed out that my parents still ate at McDonald's. They didn't even have the decency to use the drive-thru. They wanted to go in and sit at a table like it was some sort of date night. "Listen to this, Ritala," my dad said to my mom. "She's been in California for less than 2 years, and she's already turned against McDonald's, a perfectly decent establishment. You can't screw up breakfast, Chelsea. You just can't." I remember walking in with them and scowling at the menu, wondering what I would be able to eat. My dad ordered 2 bacon and egg biscuits and ordered me an egg McMuffin. The guy behind the cashier was a little slow on the uptake, and my dad's people skills were always a little gruff, unless you were an attractive woman, and then he was always nice, like Donald Trump. 2 coffees and 1 Diet Coke, he told the guy behind the counter. The cashier was for some reason confused by the request for a Diet Coke in lieu of the coffee or orange juice that came with each breakfast meal. And he was taking longer than it should have, but I remember my dad's response. "Listen, buddy, this isn't that difficult. It's breakfast, for Christ's sake, and you only have 3 options." Then he put both of his hands on the counter, cocked his head to one side, and said with complete seriousness and some concern, "Have you had all your testing done?" "Have you had all your testing done?" was the single most ridiculous line I had heard my father ever say, and I turned on my heels to find the bathroom before I urinated on myself. When I got back to the table, my mom and dad were sitting there eating their gross biscuits while my dad separated my egg from the English muffin and placed the egg alone on the paper wrapper. Then he took out a cheap bottle of vodka and put it on the table. "Here," he said. "We brought some vodka for the ride because we never know what kind of mood you'll be in." It was 10 o'clock in the morning. I would never drink the type of vodka my dad would purchase because he knew nothing about vodka, but I do remember that's when I started loving my father again. My parents rarely drank, so for them to go to a liquor store and buy alcohol meant they had been paying attention after all. Separating my carbs from protein was icing on the cake. They were back. I lay down with my head in his lap in a booth at McDonald's, looking at the paper bag of vodka, thinking, so this is what it's like to be parented. "Chels, if we knew growing up that all you needed was a little vodka to calm you down, we would have started giving it to you as a baby," my dad said, patting me on my butt as if I were a 9-year-old. "Yes, Chelsea," my mother chimed in. "Life could have been so much easier," she said, reaching over the table, pinching my nose. I propped my head up off my dad's lap. Had I known it would just take me moving across the country to get picked up on time, I would have moved to LA when I was 12. "How did that feel?" Dan asked me. "Great." I felt like a little girl. I loved that morning at McDonald's. That year in Martha's Vineyard, and every year after I visited in the summer, I would get up at 7 a.m. before any of the other kids were awake and go out to breakfast with my parents. I think of that time and our breakfast in Edgartown, and I felt loved, like they were really getting to know me and that they liked this young adult version of me. "Guts," my dad would say to me all the time. "My girl's got guts." The burden of raising me had been lifted. I had gone off on my own to California and chosen to come back without the pressure of them having to prove themselves to me. And finally, they seemed as close to being parents as they ever had. It turned out we all just needed a break. My dad has a great face. It's full of something you'd want to get involved with. He has the features of a black man, which is part of my affinity for it, but not all of it. His face represents his interest in things, his intelligence, his joy, his naughtiness. He's not cut off from things. He's not judgmental. He has always been a flirt. I like that in a guy. I love flirting. I loved flirting with my dad. He saw me in himself, and that was enough for me, and really still is. I always wanted his admiration, and when I finally got it, I was in charge of our relationship, and our dynamic flipped. I became the taker-carer of things, the one who called the shots. My dad is also the owner of a laugh that could light up an entire football field. When he laughs, he knows he's doing you a favor because it heightens the mood and sets the tone. He has the power to take all the tension out of a room with one huge smile and a head tilt, usually tension he was responsible for creating in the first place. And when he turned around a good corner, we all jumped on board without any need for an apology for the behavior that came before. We were just joyful to move on to the fun stuff, because if he was in a bad mood, everyone would be walking on eggshells. His laughter was loud, and if you could get him going, he would throw his head back and howl and then slam his hand on the dining room table, and it was infectious. No one laughs like that unless people are watching, but I never thought about that then. In those moments when he was wildly happy and playful, it was impossible to think of him as anything less than everything. What a power to have to set the tone for an entire room. What a burden. To have that kind of power means you are responsible for every mood in the room. If everyone is scared of you, then you are the one in charge. I definitely know what that feels like, because the more I write about him, the more I realize how much I am him. I kind of respect my father when I think about him in broader and more forgiving terms. Back then, he really didn't give a shit what anyone thought about him, or maybe he did. I just know what I thought of him. He was a faker, but he was also a force of nature. No person is just one thing. That's how I'm like my father. I know I'm always putting on a show. I like to be contagious. I love lighting up a room. I know how powerful that is, and I revel in it. It's when I feel the most like myself. It makes me feel smart and charming, what my father probably felt when he did it, glowing, beaming, self-satisfied. All of my summer visits after I moved to California had that same tenor. They were all a bit idyllic and more fun, and we were all adults, so there were boyfriends and girlfriends and spouses and babies, and the atmosphere in the house seemed ebullient again. My dad seemed ebullient again. He was never fully happy because he's naturally very moody, but when he was on the vineyard, we all felt the love. He would always tell me I looked too skinny, which was silly because I've never been too skinny, no matter which eating disorder I was testing out. One night we were all out to dinner. I whispered to the server that I wanted a double vodka on the rocks, and my dad chimed in. If you're going to order a double, babe, you should do it loudly and with confidence. You like your vodka, Chels. That's your ameliorant. I'm your dad. I know my own child. You've got nothing to be ashamed of. It was moments like that with my father that filled me with warm affection. Once I got older, I never really had to hide anything from him because I felt how much he adored me again. His moods were not personal. They weren't about me, at least not anymore. I always knew when my father looked at me that he thought I was smart, that I was capable, and that anyone who was in my way better get out of the way because I was filled with conviction. That was his word for me, conviction. My word for him was the prefix of that word. Then he had quintuple bypass surgery when he was in his late 60s or 70 maybe. Anyway, and then it was all